From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. More than 15 years ago, a New York City federal prosecutor named Mark Godsey had an epiphany. He discovered while teaching a law class that there was an ugly underbelly to the criminal justice system. Innocent people were being locked up. Through DNA evidence, Godsey's students helped overturn the conviction of a man serving time for a rape he did not commit. Godsey went on to help found the Ohio Innocence Project, which has so far helped to free 25 wrongfully convicted people. Now, using his own experiences as a former federal prosecutor, Godsey has written a book about the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. In his book, he exposes how prosecutors all over the country have effectively been trained to violate people's constitutional rights in order to win guilty convictions. Mark Godsey is currently a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati and, as I said, the co-founder of the Ohio Innocence Project. His book is called Blind Injustice. A former prosecutor exposes the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So how did your own experiences in, you know, more than 15 years ago as a federal prosecutor lead you to want to explore the psychology and the politics of wrongful convictions? You've seen, obviously, that it happens. You've helped to free innocent people who were convicted of crimes they didn't convict. But I'm guessing that you wouldn't have been able to write this book had you not been in the position of those people who are sending people, convicting people who haven't committed crimes.
Yeah, well, what happened was I was a prosecutor and I became a law professor. And the first place where I taught already had an innocence project. And the professor who ran it was on sabbatical that year. So the dean asked me, you know, sort of basically told me that I needed to supervise it. And as a prosecutor, I was extremely reluctant. I was very close-minded about the idea. I thought that, you know, we didn't convict innocent people. And so I was sitting in on the first meeting of the Innocence Project with the students, and they were talking about a guy named Herman May who they'd gone to visit in prison, and they were convinced he was innocent. And I was just sort of like rolling my eyes internally. But then DNA testing ended up getting his conviction overturned, and he was released. And so it was a huge eye-opening experience. I call the first chapter eye-opener. And then, you know, from that point on, I continued working, and it was an evolution through that year of learning that, you know, I'd had this mentality of being completely closed-minded to the idea and sort of arrogant, and that's what our system is. And as I've now, you know, I've been in this work, doing innocence work for almost 15 years, and our project that I founded in Ohio has freed 25 people. They served 470 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And I'm looking back on it, and I can just see, you know, I can understand it because of my days as a prosecutor, so I'm trying to explain how this happens with that sort of dual view.
So, Mark, before we sort of get into the various ways in which prosecutors end up violating people's rights inadvertently, let's talk about what it is that they are supposed to be charged with doing. You know, for the lay audience who's not familiar with how our justice system is supposed to work in its intricacies, as a prosecutor, what are you tasked with doing? Is it that you have to get a conviction at any and all costs, such as, you know, a defense lawyer has to basically defend their clients, even if they might know that their client is guilty? But what is a prosecutor's task in a courtroom?
Well, the official task is to do justice, which would be, you know, sort of remain more neutral and just try to get the right result. So if, you know, you end up dismissing the charges or if the jury ends up getting an acquittal, theoretically, a prosecutor shouldn't care. They should be like, hey, I'm neutral about all of this. But that's not how it actually works in practice. But people are competitive, and prosecutors' offices and even judges in many states are elected. And so it breeds this mentality of being tough on crime. And so everybody has to sort of flex their tough on crime muscles in the office
to
sort of
They measure their success by how many convictions they win, not whether by if justice was served.
Right. And I think they conflate the two because they get convinced that every single person they prosecute is guilty. You sort of get that mentality where you're not really open anymore. I don't think they're doing it intentionally, but it's very adversarial. It's a competitive process and they're human beings. And so, you know, you always, my side's right. My side identification And it just sort of gets out of control to the point that prosecutors aren't really looking at it objectively anymore like they're supposed to.
And is that the sort of overarching framework within which mistakes get made? You know, maybe mistake is a euphemism, but that prosecutors will pursue a conviction even if they may find that they are violating the rights of the person who has just gotten a guilty conviction.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, because again, no matter what evidence, you know, people suffer from confirmation bias. It's a well-established psychological phenomenon. There's a whole chapter in my book on it.
And so explain that. What is confirmation bias?
Well, that's the human tendency. It's sort of hardwired in our brains that we interpret new evidence in a way that confirms our pre-existing beliefs. That's why when you have a presidential debate and there's a survey afterwards and the question is which candidate was appeared more presidential, which one was more honest, the Democrats will overwhelmingly say, oh, the Democratic candidate was way more presidential. He answered the answers more honestly. He gave direct answers. And then the Republicans will say the same thing about their candidate. That's because everybody goes in with a pre-existing belief, and then you just look for evidence to confirm that. And so, you know, prosecutors, as they're going forward, I don't think they're intentionally trying to say, oh, here's some evidence that this guy's innocent. I'm just going to ignore it and convict an innocent person. In reality, what happens is they're so caught up in the competitive game of it that when evidence of innocence comes forward, their mind just goes, oh, that doesn't mean anything. That person's lying. That must be a mistake. And so they just sort of push that evidence to the side because of confirmation bias. They're not being objective anymore. But I mean, it's not just that mentality. I mean, there are many procedural things we could do to make the system more accurate, to take away some of the human biases, but we've failed to do that so far.
And I want to get to that, what you suggest with all your years of experience on different sides of the justice system. But let's talk about some of the ways in which these biases creep in. Before the era of, or before access to DNA evidence and DNA testing, rather, didn't we tend to place a lot of emphasis on eyewitnesses to crimes? And we now know that eyewitnesses are extremely unreliable.
Yeah, even when the witnesses think they're right and they say, I'm 100% confident, and you say, we now know that. Well, people who actually take the time to study know that, but unfortunately, our criminal justice system doesn't know that. And still, we'll have prosecutors seek the death penalty on very shaky and unreliable eyewitness identifications. So there's a lot more education that we have to do. I mean, all these wrongful convictions being discovered, and there's been more than 2,000 discovered in the past 25 years.
2,000?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's on the National Registry of Exonerations. Your listeners can Google it and look at all the different cases. It's called the National Registry of Exonerations. The leading cause is mistaken eyewitness identification. And so social scientists started saying, you know, in this case, 10 different eyewitnesses took the stand and said, I'm 100% positive. That's the guy I saw commit the crime. And then DNA testing proves them completely wrong. And so it spawned all these different clinical studies on human memory, and we've really demonstrated how easy it is for eyewitnesses to get it wrong and how malleable human memory is. So little suggestions by the police, it's not even intentional, but you know, the police think a witness got something wrong. They know the getaway car was white and the witness is saying, I thought it was blue. Instead of going, well, this eyewitness probably doesn't know what they're talking about, they might sort of suggest to them, are you sure it wasn't white? And then, you know, the witness will sort of change their statement. And I saw that happen. I did that myself when I was a prosecutor, not thinking I was manipulating testimony, but I just didn't understand how malleable human memory is. And so you have prosecutors who and police officers who are really taking advantage of that and shaping testimony from witnesses to fit their theory of the case. By the time these witnesses testify at trial, they might be testifying to something that's fairly different than what they originally said.
And then how do prosecutors and even judges end up using what you were saying, confirmation bias, end up convincing themselves of highly sort of unlikely and questionable things because they've decided that they know what truly happened? They want to go with their initial instinct for a particular case and then find themselves twisting the facts to suit their sort of gut reaction.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that really sort of blew my mind the most when I first started doing these innocence cases. We would have evidence proving someone conclusively innocent, and the prosecutors would come up with these ridiculous theories to try to avoid admitting that they'd made a mistake. And it just happens over and over again. Like a perfect example is, let's just take a standard case where a woman was raped, and they collected the semen from the rapist at the hospital or the rape kit. And he serves 20 years in prison. He always said he was innocent. It was a misidentification. And then, so after 20 years, they finally do DNA testing and it proves him innocent. You know, it's not his DNA in the semen. So the Innocence Project will go to court and say this guy's innocent, should be freed. And what you typically will see prosecutors do is they'll say, oh, well, this victim must have been mistaken. There must have been two men that raped her. And your client is still guilty. He just didn't ejaculate or leave any evidence at the scene. But it was his friend. We don't know his name, but he obviously did it with somebody. And that's the person who left his DNA. And they'll say that even when the record is completely clear and the witness was positive, there was only one man that raped me. And so you'll see these ridiculous sort of spinning the evidence to avoid admitting a mistake.
What about lie detector tests? I mean, you know, TV shows have conditioned us that lie detector tests are these, foolproof type methods to get the truth of what's really happened in a case. What have you found about the reliability of lie detector tests?
Well, I mean, polygraphs, lie detector tests are very unreliable. I think what will be even more surprising to your listeners is that studies have shown repeatedly in recent years that the things that human beings believe about themselves and their ability to detect when other people are lying, you know, just in common understanding, if somebody acts fidgety or they're not making eye contact or they're acting nervous, that means they're lying. Human beings generally, we all believe we can tell when somebody's lying or not. And it's pretty clear now that all those things we were taught are not true, and the human beings are not very good lie detectors. And study after study shows that. And, you know, my 25 innocent clients, most of them got on the stand at their original trials and begged the jury and said, I'm innocent, I didn't do this. And, you know, the jury's convicted them and said, you're lying. So, you know, we see it in the courtrooms that we're not very good at telling when other people are lying or not. And we see it in clinical studies. But our criminal justice system has not yet recognized that.
Mark, you say in the beginning of your book that you don't want to specifically discuss how racism plays an effect in the psychology of wrongful convictions because it's too big a topic to fit in. But we can't really have a conversation without talking about the fact that, of course, people of color, particularly African Americans, are disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system, and I'm assuming possibly disproportionately impacted by wrongful convictions.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's the biggest factor. And what I wanted to do was, I mean, that's been covered and it's extremely important. If I went into it, it would dominate the book, as it should. And it's dominated many books, as it should, because I think it is the most important factor that sways outcomes in the criminal justice system. But I wanted to focus on some other things like confirmation bias and the fact that our lie detection skills are not good and malleable memory that aren't getting as much attention. And one of the things that I was worried about is if you also say the book is about racism, the problem is everybody thinks they're not racist.
Right. So
they immediately just discount it. They go, well, this doesn't apply to me. And so my hope was that people read the book and they learn about confirmation bias. They learn about tunnel vision. They learn about all these things. And then at the end, they've actually learned more about racism because those psychological problems are the things that cause racism. So if I can almost trick them in a way, this is not going to be about racism. And then, you know, you can read it. I think by in the end, you'll understand racism better.
What role does ambition and money play into the psychology of wrongful convictions? You mentioned prosecutors are very ambitious, so they measure their success rather than by justice being served simply by the number of convictions. And also, they may have access to far more resources than a poor person facing an accusation that they don't have, you know, the money to hire a hotshot lawyer to defend themselves.
Yeah, and it's not just the lawyers. I mean, I think people don't really understand the inequalities in the system. You know, when I was a prosecutor, I had CSI type forensic experts that I could have spin the evidence any way I wanted. I could have investigators investigate. Yeah, I mean, I basically an endless budget. I could send it to any kind of lab I want, and I'd basically, and prosecutors do this. I talk about it in the book. I tell them the result I hope for up front. This is what we'd like your analysis to show. And I talk about how the confirmation bias of the forensic expert and how that sort of that contact there that shouldn't be happening, it taints the neutrality of the expert.
So even the forensic expert, the person in the lab, gets impacted by the confirmation bias because they're talking to the prosecutor.
Let me tell you a quick study, and this is amazing, because bad forensics is a leading cause of wrongful conviction. So this psychologist, Itiel Dror out of London, did this study where he went to fingerprint experts and he said, look, I've got a case where a fingerprint expert said the defendant's fingerprint was found at the scene that caused him to get convicted many years ago. But DNA testing proved him innocent. We now know that that was a mistake. The fingerprint expert made a mistake. Can you look at this, these two fingerprints, and tell me where the fingerprint expert went wrong so many years ago? And what the, each expert didn't realize is that Itiel Jor had gone into their own court files and pulled a fingerprint that that expert had testified was a match years before. So they were being tricked. And he got 80% of the fingerprint experts to change their answers because they were told something different up front. When they were told that this expert had made a mistake, not realizing they were looking at their own, 80% of them came back and said, oh yeah, this is not a match.
Oh my goodness.
And then it's like, surprise, you testified this was a match many years ago.
Wow.
And so it just shows again how when prosecutors sort of tell the answers beforehand, it shapes what people literally see. I don't think that the forensic experts are intentionally trying to sway things in order to benefit the prosecution. But when you're told an answer up front, it affects what your mind literally registers. And I talk about that in the book. This is the focus of chapter four, confirmation bias. And I go into all these forensic studies, and I actually have some studies that the reader can participate in that shows how the mind works and how information that you get beforehand affects how you view later evidence. Hmm.
The justice system is supposed to be this system of impartiality where evidence is weighed and, you know, and then judgments, the right judgments are made. But of course, it's a system that is entirely run by human beings with all our frailties, our psychological flaws, if you will. So let's talk about how one can improve it. There's much more to discuss. People can pick up a copy of book and read it themselves. It's very fascinating. What are some solutions that you would suggest to prosecutors around the country who don't want to find out that a person that they spent all this time convicting ended up spending years in prison for a crime they didn't commit? What suggestions can you make to prosecutors, but also the other people involved?
Yeah, and that's the subject of Chapter 8. Before I get into it, I want to say to anybody who's listening or watching that, I have a Facebook group, Blind Injustice, that talks about these issues. And I'm up there blogging basically on this Facebook group every day. There's opportunities for people to comment. So make sure to check that out. And I talk about these solutions. I mean, there are many. And they're basically designed to take out the human bias. So, for example, it's very simple. In the forensics, the problem I was just talking about where experts are told the right answer by police and prosecutors before they start, you set up a system where it's screened off. And instead of giving one fingerprint and say, match this to the one at the crime scene, they're given six different people's fingerprints. And the expert's not told beforehand whether they're supposed to make an inclusion, a match, or they're supposed to eliminate each of them. So in other words, they're acting in complete neutrality. And it would not be expensive.
I mean, this is how a scientist would conduct an experiment. And you would imagine that these should be the standards.
You've nailed it. That's the basic thing of the scientific method in this country for decades, if not centuries. That science needs to be done blindly and neutrally so you don't know the answer before you start. In fact, if you know you went to a mall and somebody was taking a Coke versus Pepsi taste test and the person administering the test knew which one was the Coke and which one was the Pepsi, you would say that's not a valid survey because they might be swaying or influencing the people. But yet we have our forensics and our criminal justice system set up that way, and we send people to death row in circumstances where we're not using basic tenets of the scientific method. So it's shocking. Hmm. So many of the solutions are very easy. The same with eyewitness identification. Even unconscious and sort of subconscious indicators by the officer showing the six-person photo lineup to a witness, it's been demonstrated time and time again, can sway the witness and cause them to make a bad identification. And so the officer who goes out and shows the six pictures to the witnesses should not be the same one who's working on the case and doesn't know which one is the right answer. Very, very simple. One of the leading causes of wrongful convictions is false confessions. And I think people who saw the documentary Making a Murderer were able to understand that when they saw Brendan Dassey's confession. The reason why we understand that Brendan Dassey gave a false confession is that it was videotaped. But most states don't videotape it. And so we need to have interrogations videotaped from beginning to end so that later we can come back and we can see how it unfolded and determine whether it's reliable or not, or what kind of pressures or things were used during the interrogation. So it's not that we are distrustful that, you know, police and prosecutors are intentionally trying to do anything wrong. It's just that we've been far too arrogant in our abilities, and we've not screened off and taken precautions for human failings, human psychological failings of bias and different things like that, that we really shouldn't be surprised exist in the criminal justice system because they exist everywhere else. Yeah. And we don't have a problem following the scientific method in other areas.
So finally, Mark, I want to sort of underscore what's at stake here. And you know better than myself and probably my audience what's at stake, having been involved in the Ohio Innocence Project that has helped to free 25 wrongfully convicted people. to think about somebody who is innocent spending so much of their life paying a price for something they didn't do, basically a destruction of their life, is just a horrific thing to have to think about. And I suppose with some very simple things like the ones, suggestions you just made, it could go such a long way towards preventing people from being wrongfully convicted. So put that human face on the stakes in this issue.
Well, I'll tell you the story of Ricky Jackson. He was one of our clients that was freed. He set a national record. He spent almost 40 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit, and was on death row for part of that, and came within a couple of months of his execution when, because of pure luck, a technicality in the paperwork, he was moved off of death row and moved to life in prison. So he was just turned 18 years old when he was fingered by a mistaken eyewitness identification and sent to death row for a murder he didn't commit. He had no criminal record whatsoever. He had big dreams for his life. And he spent almost 40 years. He went in as an 18-year-old. He got out in his late 50s. And he was just released in 2014. He's got a TED Talk that he gave at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Google Ricky Jackson Met TED Talk, and you'll see an incredibly inspirational figure, because, you know, that would break most people, and he had a choice to either break and go crazy or find a way to make sense of it. And he found a way to make sense of it. And once you've made sense of something like that, all the little things that bother us in our daily lives is child play to him. And so talking to Ricky is like climbing to the top of a mountain in Nepal and meeting some, you know, Buddhist monk. He's just an incredible human being.
Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. So people can go to facebook.com and search for Blind Injustice, where they'll find your Facebook page. We'll also post a link to it from our site directly as well. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. My guest is Mark Godsey, professor of law at the University of Cincinnati, award-winning former federal prosecutor in New York City before he became a lead attorney and activist for the wrongfully convicted, co-founder of the Ohio Innocence Project. And we've been discussing his new book, Blind Injustice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.